Why do you say that, Father? You aren't afraid, are you?
No. But I respect some of the superstitions of others. Often they are founded in fact.
Broadcasting live from our Sanctum Sanctorum in Venice, California, this is the Sixth Sense Society. I'm your host, Krista, here with our producer, Michael, and today we welcome back to the show a good friend and psychotherapist, Merle Yost. And he's been on the show before teaching us about boundaries, a sense of self, and today he's coming back to talk about spirituality and sexuality, which is definitely a hot topic. But before we get started, Michael has a few announcements.
Hi, everybody, and yes, welcome to our show. We've got some great stuff coming up for you guys. Next week, our show falls on tax day when everybody has to pay their taxes. So in honor of that, we're going to have our good friend and witchcraft practitioner, Sandra Inman, on, all the way from Australia, and she'll be doing a show on prosperity magic to help you guys out a little bit with that. And then the last Tuesday, we have Dolly Safran, who was subject of a alien abduction, and we'll have our good friend, Matt Apsher, co-hosting that one. So you guys definitely want to tune in for that. That's going to be a lot of fun. Get all the information on our website, sixthsensesociety.com, S-A-X-T-H, all spelled out. And while you're there, if you can afford to, buy us a coffee on Ko-Fi. But one of the biggest things you can do is go to YouTube and on our channel, click like and subscribe, and that helps a lot. And we're going to start working on guests for May as well. So if you guys have any recommendations, reach out to us and we're always happy to find new people. And then also in May, we're starting our seven-week series of tarot classes again. So if you guys are interested in that, reach out also and we'll give you guys all the information as well. So lots going on, and I don't want to take up too much time because I love having Merle on. It's just so much fun and so fascinating. So I'm going to kick it back to you guys. So take it away, Krista.
Great. Thank you, Michael. And welcome, Merle.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back. It's always fun.
It is fun. So I'm interested, before we get started, sort of when you got interested in the concept of blending spirituality and sexuality, because not everybody will necessarily even do that in their lifetime.
I think it came out of my long-term relationship. I was in a relationship for 19 years, and we had a really profound connection and a really intense sexual connection. And just the longer and more we got into this, we ended up getting into these really profound altered states that were deeply connected. And part of that was also my deepening into Buddhism and my explorations there. But then the combination of that, and then I had to step back and look to see what created those conditions. But part of it was just the fact that we had such a deep connection and had been essentially monogamous for a long, long time. And so I over 15 years. So that really made a really big difference. So,
and so when you talk about spirituality and in this context, what does that really mean for you?
I think I have to give a little context to that. Sexual energy is life energy. I mean, on every level. And so, well, we were two men and we weren't interested in creating a child or life, but there was still the life that we were connected to in between the two of us in that endeavor. And as we, over time, revealed more and more and more of who we were to each other, and especially sexually, in terms of what are your deepest fantasies, what really turns you on, what's going on inside of you when we're having sex, and not being shamed by that and incorporating that in some form, there creates this depth of connection that then transcends just the act of what's going on there, because you suddenly get out of your own way. You're not lost in your head. You're not lost in the fantasy. You're lost in the connection that's happening with this other person. When you've pulled away all of those barriers, all of a sudden it just deepens dramatically. And we'd find that we would be, and this time got really almost stopped. It was so slow. Everything was in super slow motion. And there was this profound intensity, and we were just fully aroused, but not in the sense of about to have an orgasm, but in the sense that everything was alive. And we would just stay in that altered state. And then when we had the orgasm, we'd slowly come out of that. But it really profoundly altered us. And I think changed us. It certainly changed the relationship. And it certainly changed our connection to sex and sexuality. And I think to the divine, for lack of a better description. Some people describe the orgasm as the way of connecting to the divine. It's the universal unconsciousness would be more my description of that. And so, but they do it so fleetingly, or they're so focused on the fantasy or the interaction that's going on at this moment, that they're missing a bigger picture of just being in that experience. Suddenly it's like being in the middle of a fireworks show. And if you can stay in that fireworks and see what that's illuminating, mm-hmm. then you have a different experience than if you're, oh, I got off. And we now collapse in exhaustion and like recover and then try again or do what we're going to do next. But it's being open to the possibility that there's so much more as opposed to the narrow parameters of which we put around sex in our society.
One of the things I learned in my 30s through someone I was with for a while was the idea of letting energy flow without trying to control it. So that even if you think, okay, let's go over and we're going to have sex together, you don't do that. You just relax and let the energy happen. And it was actually a really good lesson on just not controlling and that idea like you're talking about that, you know, sexuality is really life force. And the more you can be open to how that wants to be that day, and some days you're just hot and heavy, and other days you're not. I also learned when we were like not getting along, I could feel the repulsion like so clearly. And that's better not to engage in when you're not feeling connected.
Unless you like that particular kind of sex.
Exactly.
But sure.
But the other thing that came up when you were talking about this concept of communicating what you really are turned on by, and that seems to be something that many of us don't know how to do because there's zero education.
Well, and there's so much shame.
Yeah.
We live in a puritanical culture, if I could talk today. And so sex in our culture is shame-based. Sex is evil. Sex is this, sex is that. But and it's only about creation, and you can't have too much pleasure. And so we have all these rules and guidelines around what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And sex is not any of that. It's really about connection and intimacy and play. And we don't get enough play in our life. Everything's so serious, and we have to make sex so serious. And we've turned sex into performance art. And so we're missing the whole point of the intimacy and the connection. And if you can get through all of these layers of shame and inner dialogues about performance, am I pleasuring this person enough? Are they pleasuring me enough? Am I doing this right? Are they doing that wrong? And it's like, oh my God, you're so busy thinking about all this. You can't simply be in the moment mm-hmm. and deepen into that connection with this other person. Not merge. Merging is bad. Joining with them in this experience. That's where that really happens. Because if you lose yourself in the other person, then you're missing the experience of what's going on. Mm-hmm. The connection happens at the contact boundary. And that's where joining with each other, and you have the maximum amount of contact at that boundary between the two of you, that creates all this potential excitement. And then by building on that, it can just become these ecstatic states. And it isn't about having the biggest orgasm or the strongest erection or whatever. It's really about just being there with this other person and seeing what comes of that connection and letting it go. And generally, in my experience, the more time that you spend having sex with someone, the more over length of time, the greater potential for pleasure. Because when you first meet somebody and you have sex with them, you're so busy trying to figure out what you're supposed to be doing, what they want or what they don't want. And I'm a massive proponent of before you ever have sex with somebody, you should have long conversations with them about what sex means to them, what do they like, what do they not like. Because I equate it to not doing that is like throwing a Hail Mary pass, mm-hmm. and you hope that there's somebody in the end zone to catch it. And instead of having this dialogue beforehand, and you have a roadmap to what works for this person and what doesn't, so that it makes the whole interaction a whole lot easier. Because we so complicate first sex with somebody, unless it's just a sheer holes and pulls, and we're going to get off as quickly as possible and move on. And that's fine if that works for you. Personally, I find it incredibly boring, but to each his own. I think there's a lot of people having that kind of sex as a whole because they think that's what sex is.
The other thing that strikes me, and maybe you could address this, is it seems to me that people have a different persona around sexuality in general. So you have a range of people that are naturally, maybe at least at certain points of their life, more sexual because of their hormones, and people that aren't necessarily as sexual. This idea that we are all supposed to be the same at certain ages, it seems to me, having lived as a long life as a woman, is my sexuality has basically changed and it goes in cycles. And I'm okay with that, but sometimes the culture isn't. And, you know, because that idea that you're always, like, for a woman anyway, I'm always supposed to be attractive and sexual. I'm like, that's just way too much for me. And there are times you really don't want to be, you know. And that even if you don't have that pressure in your relationship, you do have it in the culture a little bit, you know. And I wonder, you know, in a way, maybe spirituality can help that. Like, if you view sexuality as spirituality, you can see it maybe in a more well-rounded way.
I agree with what you said. I guess the caveat I would put in there is I think what we're not dealing with in our culture and in many cultures, because it's simply a part of the culture, is early childhood sexual abuse. And that children get sexualized too early before they have the brain capacity to process and tolerate that. And so then they think that means sex. Because they get hyperstimulated, they're overwhelmed, and that's what, and your first sexual experience sets the framework for what you think sex is. So any of these early incursions into a child's reality, pornography, sex play, particularly with somebody who's older, or a child who's been sexually abused who then starts training the other kids. And that's one of my specialties, so I see this a lot. And men get boys get sexualized really early. In certain cultures, when the boy turns 13, 14, they march him off to a prostitute to get laid, to make a man out of him, not knowing that that's actually sexual abuse. And then he spends the rest of his life sexual and compulsive, trying to live out that experience over and over and over again in order to unconsciously try to process it, but it's not processable if he doesn't even understand that it's abuse.
Right.
So that complicates all of this. Yes, I'm in my 60s, and there are times that I'm much more game for sex on a regular basis than others. And there are times, especially in long-term relations, there are periods where you just stop having sex for a while. But the point is to reinitiate that and not think, well, this is just the way it's going to be from now on. And understand we're all going through cycles. We all have stresses in our life. And sometimes that sexual energy gets poured into creative projects or into our work, or we're just depressed and tired. And so we have to accommodate that. And that's what the point of being in a relationship is, that a long-term one is that they can read you and they can support you through that and say, I'm here and I want you to know that intimacy is available if you're willing, you're able to let that in, because I think it actually help where you are right now, because we feel alone way too much. And I think when we feel alone, that's often when that a lot of that libido goes away, because there's no contact going on. There's no excitement happening at the contact boundary. And so our partners can do a lot to keep that connected.
That's a great observation, that feeling of being alone, and that sexuality and intimacy can absolutely be together. Because I do think sometimes, at least the way it's viewed, it's not always viewed together. And then that's why you'll see people like, oh, that's my best friend, but I don't want to have sex with them. And I'm like, really? It's their best friend? You don't want to have sex with them? I mean, that always been a little puzzling to me. But it makes sense if there's been abuse, or you actually think that it is that different.
They're separate things. And they can be.
Well, absolutely.
But sadly enough, in too many relationships and marriages, they are separate things. Mm-hmm. But it mostly has to do with all that early training. And so many kids get hijacked early on. And boys being sexually abused, there's actually a recent study out that suggests strongly that boys get sexually abused much more often than girls. I know that's not popular culture, because but that part of the problem is that boys aren't allowed to be sexual abuse survivors or victims because they're boys. They're supposed to protect themselves. I mean, the moment they pop out, we tell them their job is to protect mom. They don't get to be a little kid and powerless. And so we've screwed up this culture so badly with so many misunderstandings of what childhood is and what growing up and sexuality and all this, and it's causing us so many problems.
It's true, too. And then also there's the cultural movies and things around sexuality. And one of the things I did notice when I first got married was there's not a lot of support for long-term relationships. And you have to be careful. Like, I learned very quickly not to tell certain people anything about my problems because they were so biased. And even when I liked them, they were good friends, they would always want to be on my side, but I was wrong a lot of the times. I mean, I had a and I knew it. I knew I had something to do with it. So I said, well, I've got to be careful who I talk to about my marriage if I want real support. And it's one of the things I just noticed early on is it's we want the initial, like, okay, we're in love. And then how do we help each other as a culture support long-term relationships?
Well, we stay out of it for other people until they ask for help. And also we have to look at our own biases is what we're bringing to that. And that's what most people don't understand, is that they've got a certain framework on this. And if they haven't looked to see where that framework came from and whether it was really useful to the people that brought it to them, then they're just perpetuating that same dysfunction onto other people and one generation to the next. Most people don't do their own work. There's an old 12-step adage to one of my favorites. Is it's much easier to take somebody else's inventory than to take your own inventory.
That is so true.
And so if I can go over there and fix your relationship, I don't have to worry about mine over here because it's just going to die anyway. So it doesn't matter. And there's too many dead relationships with people still together. Mm-hmm. And that's not good for them. It's not good for any of the people around them either. We don't... It's so ironic that we're having such a battle in this country over sexual education at the moment as being grooming, quote unquote, because education actually protects children from being abused.
Absolutely.
And so what they're doing is they're setting them up to be abused, which I think is just unbelievably crazy and sick. But we don't really teach them about relationships because we can't agree about what a healthy relationship looks like. Mm-hmm. They're stuck in a religious perspective, they're stuck in this perspective or that one, and consequently, they're in these narrowed hallways that they can't get out of, and consequently, they're just passing that, perpetuating that same mythology on. And we need to have real education about what real intimacy is, what real sex is, what real contact with people and respecting boundaries. And we can't, or not, in big part because we can't agree on that, because people haven't been able or willing to look at their own stuff enough to understand that what they're doing doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a key to a lot of things, is working on yourself and working through, like you said, not just even abuse, but even concepts you've been told as a child or that you've just taken on without thinking about it. Do I believe that? What do I believe about it? And getting to think for yourself as well is another really important aspect of everything, I think.
Well, one classic example, I won't go into the whole story on this, but I got into a discussion with an old classmate from when I was in grade school. And it was a conversation about Pete Buttigieg when he was running for president. And he says, well, he can't have children. And I said, okay. And so his point was, that sex was for procreation. I said, well, okay, so let's look at that. Let's look what that really means. So that means is before you get married, you should have to take an exam to make sure that you're fertile and can have children. Otherwise, there's no point in getting married. I said, and then once you're past the childbearing age, then chastity devices, castration, what are you going to do to keep you from having sex? Because then you're no longer procreating, so there's no point of having sex. So they're missing the point of sex. Sex is about deepening the intimacy between two people, making connection. If you're looking for a relationship, I mean, there's surely plenty of hookups and that people are doing for a whole different reasons, and that's fine if that's where they're at. But as long as we hold on to these mythologies about what sex is, then it's going to be problematic to do anything about intimacy and contact, increasing pleasure and deepening relationships.
So let's talk a little bit about the idea of Tantra, and since that is a word that gets thrown around a lot, both in the Western and Eastern tradition, and even I trained in Tibetan Buddhism, and my idea of Tantra was actually non-sexual because of our training, and they're all legitimate, but that was initially because the Tantric was with the deity, the Tantra was union with the deity, and by the way, that does help one's sex life.
It does.
You don't expect it to, but it definitely can. And so let's talk about what that means to you and how you view it in terms of spirituality and sexuality.
Well, my understanding of Tantra and the Buddhist tradition, it's actually the most intense path that you can take towards enlightenment. But it really means to work through all of the illusions about who you think you are. Because we then use those illusions to take us out into the world and pretend, and then when they get popped, we get upset and things don't work well. But by working through all of that, you simply come truly profoundly into yourself, completely vulnerable in the positive way, not the negative way. And so then you're just available to both that universal consciousness as well as to other people, because there's no walls there, because you don't need them to defend yourself or to protect yourself. You have other ways of handling that. And so if we bring that into a sexual context, we're back to my comment about truly revealing to your partner who you are and what you like and what you don't like, because we have so much shame around most of that. The term I use is eroticized shame. It's like spank me, or I've been a bad girl, or I'm a slut, or I'm a whore, I'm a whatever. And so those are all negative self-statements that say there's a shame around having sexuality. It's eroticized shame. And it's one of the easiest things to turn on to. If you're sexually abused, and it's painful and or pleasurable. So if you have to choose between focusing on the pain, then you don't do that. If you have a choice, if it's only pain, then you focus on that. If there's pain and pleasure, then you focus on the pleasure, because that's how you're going to survive it. But because that then becomes eroticized for you, that becomes a part of your sexuality, and that's part of your hardwiring. But so much and religious stuff is about eroticized shame as well. They're talking about all this glorious sex, and they say, but it's sinful to do this. So if they're not sinning, they're not having good sex. And in my own experience, gay men who grew up in extremely religious households, and this was much more so during the height of the AIDS crisis, were much more likely to become HIV positive. Because they had to be punished for being gay. And so I think with the advent of the current drugs, it's much less common, but I still see it happening, which I think is unfortunate, because they're just living out that programming that they were given. And we need to work through that eroticized shame. And that's something almost no one talks about at all, let alone actually face it and deal with it. And it's a big part of what most people's internal a drama about sex is, or why they're even having sex, or what the meaning is. I remember asking someone, so if when you're having sex with a guy, if you're fucking him, if I could be so crude, said, what does that say about you that you're penetrating him? And what does that say about him that you're penetrating him? And most of them have never thought about that. But it's all playing out underneath in what's going on. And that's, I'm sure that's true in heterosexual sex at all. What does it mean that I'm having sex with you? What does it mean that you're having sex with me? We have all these layers of morality and meaning and so forth. And if we aren't owning them and processing and working them through, then they're in the way of the intimacy and the contact and really deepening into the erotic energy that's possible.
So going back to the eroticized sexuality idea, does that mean that if you are into kink, most of it's dysfunctional, or is there room for people that just like I know in Zen Buddhism, they will, if you go to meditation, they'll hit your back if you want, And it's supposed to release the energy. And you can say no. And I said no because I didn't know what I'd feel. But I wished I had afterwards because you're so like, oh, my God, I'm sitting here forever. But and they know how to do it. They're trained. Right. And it's not like a, you know.
They're not beating
it's
you.
Like, yeah. So what is your view on people that have a naturally different way of being sexual in the world?
Well, but all sexuality comes of our experience. I think all BDSM is eroticized shame. And I don't mean that as a pejorative at all. It's just simply a description of what's going on. Because in order to be beaten, you have to have an enjoyment in that beating. There has to be a meaning to you to that beating. I've seen too many ads of guys who say, I'm looking for somebody who can beat me the way my father did.
Well, that does seem traumatic.
That's not subtle. but there are subtle layers of that going on. A lot of the abuse that happens in families is emotional. Granted, there's certainly plenty of physical abuse, but there's also plenty of emotional abuse and emotional incest and intrusion and violating those boundaries energetically. And so all of that gets made sense out of in some way. And if there's a pleasure attached to that in some form, if the way you feel love is to have your boundary crossed, then that becomes eroticized for you. And I would call that probably some degree of eroticized shame from a little to a lot. And if dad or mom got off on spanking you, you're going to feel that energy coming off the shame of them, and then you just naturally absorb that. It's just how the process works. So sex is incredibly complicated. It's one of the most complicated things we do, and the one that we give the least amount of attention and real analysis to.
One of the things I've thought about, being that I'm also interested in the yogic aspects of Tantra, and even though I never practiced it, I did receive some teachings about the inner channels, and that's one of the reasons for doing Tantra is enlightenment.
Yes, that
and
is the whole goal.
It's a whole physiological thing. The other thing I was taught was that if you were to do a tantric sexual relationship, that you had to be at the same level. That and this is just for someone that is interested in using sexual energy to open
those pathways,
and that it can be quite painful. That it was not always initially pleasurable because you're like
usually painful.
So I mean, I always thought that was really it seems quite hard work. I mean, it's not like, you know. So what was my whole point about that? Now I can't even remember what my point was. Oh, the bodies. Okay, so the energy bodies. I just think about, you know, because I have clients that break up with someone and they energetically have a hard time releasing people, and it seems to me there are times where, for whatever reason, your energy bodies get so connected, and that we don't have methods consciously saying, let's find a way to
disconnect
the energy bodies. And that's why you'll have dreams of them. And even though you say, I really love this other person, but I still feel haunted. And
I think we're back to merger.
Maybe that's it.
I think that people have merged and they haven't figured out how to unmerge. Because then they're trying to merge with this other person now, and this person's still in there, and it's getting a little crowded inside. Oh, let's just have an orgy and be done with it. You're like, which may be the solution, I'm not sure. But there are better ways to disconnect. But that's part of our whole two shall become as one. It's our whole mythology about relationship and marriage in particular, is that you're supposed to merge. And I think it's the most destructive thing you can do to relationship. Excitement happens at the contact boundary. And if you are merged, there's no place for that excitement to get sparked. And so you have to stay in you, in intimacy and in contact, but not merged. And that's just anti our whole dialogue around relationship. And so your better half, I mean, really? No, they're a whole and you're a whole. So it deeply frustrates me, and I don't hear a lot of conversation, even the psychotherapeutic community, about changing that narrative. So
how would one go about doing that then? Through just your own writing about it?
Well, taking my classes and reading my books will help.
That's true.
Because I'm really big on this. And the people who do it actually find it really can profoundly impact their lives. But really understanding energetic boundaries, Because when we talk about boundaries, you talk, well, that person's too close to me, or they looked at me, or something. It's all of this external stuff, like you're defenseless, and you have no way of taking care of yourself. And so once you really understand energetic boundaries, what they are and how they work, all of a sudden you have all of these abilities to take care of you and to keep them out, no matter what they're doing. And so we're raised to be defenseless. I mean, when every time I meet somebody, the parent with a child, I said, how soon are you enrolling them in martial arts? Especially girls. I said, because if you know you can defend yourself, that changes your whole experience of being in the world. Otherwise, you're just sending the victims out to the chickens to be slaughtered. And that's just cruel and wrong, and it's unnecessary. And especially true for girls who get set up to be victimized by our society's setup or system, and they need to know how to take care of themselves.
I so agree with you. I thought about if I ever had a daughter, and there's this, I remember reading this on somewhere on Facebook, there's this Indian martial artist, she's like in her 80s, and she can still take care of herself.
Yes.
And you do feel differently about the world if you know, sure, someone can still take you out under certain circumstances.
Sure.
But even that, I took this self-defense course called Wendo in Canada, and it was designed by a martial artist woman who actually got attacked in a bathroom and still didn't defend herself. So she came up with this other thing because she wasn't going to take it, right? And it was really interesting. It was like a mix of moves and psychology. And one was, this is what where in the psychological part, you disrupt the person sometimes by just speaking to them, like as a person. And sometimes that she gave examples that just kind of happened. They're like said something, they immediately are disrupted because they don't expect you not to be afraid. And so we were taught that. And even that little bit of a course made me feel really good, because I knew I now had some techniques, some of which I would already was doing in terms of like watching if someone's following you, just cross the street and, you know, see if they really are. And I thought that was really, it makes a difference for a woman, I think. And even as you get older, as an old person, if you know how to like knock someone with your cane.
Just the fact that you aren't afraid can often put people off, because they're so determined. They're so convinced you're going to collapse immediately because they're so powerful. You maybe have heard me tell this story before, but several years ago when I was driving up the Bay Area, I got into this road rage situation. This car came up behind me, really, this truck actually. I was in my little Fiat. And he tried to run me off the road for the next 20 miles. And finally, as I was trying to exit off of 101, he was able to block the intersection and literally stop traffic on 101 in the exit. And he got out of his truck and came over. And I just lowered my window a little bit. And he was just screaming nonsense to me. Nonsense. I had no idea what was going on or why. I'm assuming he thought I'd cut him off or something somewhere or something. I have no idea. He couldn't tell me. And I listened to him and I just kept saying to him, I don't understand anything you're saying. I was not mad. I just said that. And so I then saw a way to get away, and I went and I pulled away, and he didn't follow me at that point anymore. Because I think he discharged enough of that. I didn't collapse. I took care of myself, and I just simply met him with calmness. So it didn't match his fantasy of whatever that was, that interaction was about, assuming there was an interaction. So I agree with that. I mean, if they have a gun and they're shooting, that's very different, obviously, but which is all too common in this country now. But the what I call it is the unexpected response.
Yes.
And so, and that's, I'm particularly good at that one. I'll say something like a woman, I worked customer service line many years ago for a health insurance, mental health insurance company. And this therapist called in, she was just hot mad. And she was going, rah, 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 rah. And I let her take a breath. And I said, and that's probably an understatement. And she just burst into laughter. And then we had a very reasonable conversation, but I had to let her vent. I said the last thing in the world she was expecting at that moment, and it just worked. So the unexpected response is one of the best defenses you can possibly have.
Yeah, I agree. That's worked for me. I never knew that's what it was called. I mean, one way of saying it, it's true. But it's interesting, you know, since we're talking about the concept of feeling safe, let's apply it to sexuality in the sense of, People, you know, even if people have worked on themselves, they can still have trauma later in life for a variety of reasons.
Absolutely.
So let's say they need to create a safe space again to be able to go into those intimate spaces. What are some of the things you would suggest for people that know that they have a new trauma or been re-traumatized by a relationship?
Well, again, we're back to simply talking about it with your partner to let them know what's going on up here and not expecting them to read your mind and to know exactly what's going on. The more that you share, the more you're going to deflate the potential fear of what's going on because you're heard, you're seen, assuming there's empathy and awareness going on the other person's side. And then you can talk about how this is going to work with this particular context. And so that you set some parameters and some boundaries, and assuming that your partner's respectful, then you have a safe container to move into that. And so there's no substitute for communication. You have to open your mouth and talk about what's going on with you, whether it's painful or not. And I think this is particularly true for women who've been raped and then try to go back into a relationship with their partners. That's extraordinarily difficult because it's going to trigger all that possibility. So they have to talk to their partner about their experience. They have to talk about their fear of what's going to come up when they try and attempt to have sex. And maybe they take baby steps to build up to that. So they rebuild that trust, not so much in the partner, but in the experience of having that kind of experience. And so consequently, it's communication, communication, communication. There's just no substitute for that. And we don't. And if we have too much shame about sex, we can't talk about it.
Well, it's not only, I think, that, but culturally, I'm not sure why, we don't view communication as sexy. Unless it's like, hey, baby, you know, some sort of sex talk. And yet it is very sexy because, you know, it opens things up and things open up. You start to feel all the juices running.
Right.
So that, again, that seems to be something that is perpetuated through movies and film. Maybe not books so much. There's some good books and novels that have, like, real dialogue sexually.
Well, but we miss the point that intimacy is what creates erotic contact. And the more you communicate with your partner, the better communicator you are, the more intimacy you're going to have, and the easier it is to move into that erotic space. Because is it not after a sweet dinner and you've had this fun time and you're just relaxed, completely defenseless, all of a sudden that energy starts moving up and you're ready to move into the next zone. But it's because you've had all this contact, you've had all this intimacy without having to perform. And sex to some degree is performance. It just is, because we're not doing and with or without conversation, and I personally think sex with conversation is actually much more interesting than without. So you're telling each other what's going on. And there maybe get to points you don't need to talk because you're so connected at that point that you are completely tuned in. And that's wonderful, but that doesn't usually happen at the beginning point. That's somewhere down the road where you've been having sex for a long time. You know this person, you can read them, and you understand how they're thinking and how they work. And then it just works. But sex should be very chatty. In a good way. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think we should repaint the ceiling? Kind of a turnoff at that moment. But we don't, and couples just don't communicate. They think because you're a couple, you just automatically know everything, or you should know everything. And then you shame them if they don't know this. And that's really problematic. One of the things that ended my long-term relationship was that we were vacationing in Paris at the time, and I got really depressed over something that happened in our prior stop in London. And he could not tell I was depressed. And I was really profoundly depressed. And that's something I didn't normally get into. And then he got mad at me when I told him I felt like he should be able to read my emotions after that was 18 years. And he said he thought I was wanting him to be a psychotherapist. So I just wanted to be a human being there with me. And I thought after 18 years, he should be able to have some sense of my moods and what's going on. And so it really was devastating to the relationship because he simply wasn't capable or willing to go to that level of intimacy, and it showed.
Yeah, depression's a hard one in terms of, you know, figuring out if you are depressed temporarily, maybe, or one of the things, believe it or not, I had surgery in my 40s, and I, you know, I worked pretty hard most of my life, and I was tired a lot before the surgery. And then, so after I had my surgery, I had to be in bed for like a month. And it was the best thing ever.
Oh, really?
Oh, my God. Because I never rested.
You had permission to stop.
I had, and I said, this is never going to happen again. Now, I can't say I'm perfect about it, but I was not grumpy. I mean, some of it was the surgery, but some of it was I realized I really needed to learn to rest. Mm. Not just, you know, do things that are looking like rest, but they're not, you know, like watching TV. And it taught me that also, and this relates to sexuality, is taking care of one's body and being aware of all of the cycles. For me as a woman, maybe I am forced to do that, but I have to admit it's really helpful if I know what's going on with me physically, and it's not necessarily mental. And so then I can say, yes, well, I can take care of this physically. And
yes,
and that adds to my pleasure in terms of sexuality.
Well, it's taking responsibility for you, and too many people in a relationship think it's the other person's responsibility to take care of them 100%, and they don't have to do that. Like, no, I mean, we're back to that boundary thing. We're not merged. We're not one being. And so you should be able to read your partner as best you can, and nobody's ever 100%. I'm a psychotherapist, and I'm not 100% at it. I'm pretty good. But we have these unrealistic expectations that come out of what we think relationships mean and what intimacy means, and most people are completely uneducated. I remember I attended a group, a gay men's group, spirituality, and there was this conversation. I was the first, only time I went, and there were like 15, 20 guys and probably 19 to 65 or something or older, and it got very clear that they had no idea what intimacy was. And the lead of the group didn't have any idea what he was doing, so I took over. And so I gave them a definition of intimacy, and they were absolutely shocked. These guys had never been educated that intimacy was the act of being vulnerable with another person, revealing a part of you and taking the risk that you're going to be rejected. And when you're rejected, you know this is not where you belong. And if you're not rejected, then that deepens the trust, that allows you to open up more of you, and it does for them as well. And that's how you deepen into these deep levels of intimacy, which lead to sex, which lead to tantra and all these other things that we're talking about. But it's really as simple as simply taking the risk of revealing a part of you that you were afraid might get you rejected. That changes everything. When they don't reject you, all of a sudden, isn't that when you're dating somebody and you say something to them and they say, oh, that's okay, or I understand, or blah, 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 doesn't that open the door to you opening up yourself to that person more? And when you get to the really deep stuff, that's when things get really serious. And that's what you hope that a partner in a long-term relationship is able to see all of you enough to hold that and not shame you about that, and simply help you hold that space so that you can work through that. And that's what it really comes down to. Because if you're not shaming them about something you feel shame about, they may very well work through that shame. Mm-hmm. Light is the antidote to shame. You have to shine light on it. 12-step meetings are all about coming in and sharing my shame about having done this or done that and not being shamed by the group, but being accepted. That's where the healing takes place.
Yeah, the shame is a big component, it seems like, in reaching intimacy sexually. Now, one of the things I've talked to a couple of my women friends about this, is as a woman, I still feel I am learning what really sexuality is for me. There's so much training and culturalization, particularly when I was younger and people thought, oh, you look sexy, and I never felt really comfortable with that. You know, being trapped in that label, like I don't mind compliments, but it was like it didn't make sense to me too. And then the other thing is I've noticed that for me is the idea of the erogenous zones, they're not all genital. Like it's You know, I give this example.
Half of them are mental.
Like, well, I was in fourth grade or fifth grade. My brother set me up to kiss this boy. I don't know why they did this, honestly. Never did it ever after that. And what he did was he just stroked my arm for quite a while.
Mm.
This is a kid.
Mm.
And it was really amazing what it made me feel like. And now everyone's body is different, too. So that's
the
other thing. Hence
the conversation about the roadmap to your pleasure.
Right.
Because if you don't like your nipples sucked on, male or female, and they're obsessed with sucking in your nipples, well, this is going to be really boring. So, I mean, if you don't give them a roadmap, they don't know. They're going to try this and try that. And it's like them spend all their time trying as opposed to actually
just
giving you
them
what you want.
Yeah.
Communication, communication, communication. It's the most important part of sex.
Yeah, it is.
Really is. Without that, you're just sort of like throwing darts and seeing if you hit the wall. And it's like, really?
Michael and I started watching this show, How to Build a Sex Room. And this British woman, and she's an interior designer. And she's actually very brilliant. And actually, the show is really interesting. And because the people that go on it are quite open about their sexuality, and they're all really different. And she really has no judgment about it.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, she also builds these amazing rooms that you can see fit. Like, one was a couple, they wanted more like a honeymoon suite. And the idea of the show is also so that it can support intimacy, like people that are, you know, busy with kids, and that this space represents, we're going to be in this space together. And I've really enjoyed the psychological side, but also that people have been so vulnerable about,
I'll say, they're revealing their fantasies.
Yeah,
they're telling you exactly what turns them on.
Yeah.
And that's glorious.
And I thought that's really healthy, you know. It's really a really fun show to watch. And she's a real character. She's like, I don't know, her 50s or so. And you could tell she's really not remotely judgmental. You never see her react to anything. Oh, she says, oh, that's wonderful. Okay, we're going to do this and that. And she's very playful. And I like that she is an older woman doing this show for a variety of reasons, you know, because I think aging and sexuality, that could be another topic about suddenly you're not supposed to be sexual as you're older.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's getting better, but, you know, there's a lot of bad jokes about, you know, older people and sex, you know. So anyway, it's really delightful to see. And I thought, well, this shows that culturally some people are getting the idea of communicating.
Yeah, It goes across the board. I mean, it's certainly essential for good sex, as far as I'm concerned. Otherwise, you're just using the other person as something to rub on, and what I call holes and poles again. And that's not sex to me. That's just masturbation using another body, and that to me is kind of gross. But to each his own. But if you really want intimacy, you have to talk, you have to communicate, you have to find out who this person is, and you have to let them know who you are.
And that's an interesting point. I remember meeting someone. I didn't really date this person. And basically, he was quite young. He said he had all these different fantasies. He was just going to go live out with somebody before he got serious. And
and
I suppose you can do that. But to me, that didn't seem very interesting. I remember thinking at the time. And I thought, well, but at least he was honest with himself.
Like, he's telling you what his shame was. So he had to do all these shameful things with other people because he couldn't possibly do that with his partner.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah, I didn't think of it that way at all. No, at the time. But yeah, it seems to me that having a partner in life is also, it's important to know that you might not be able to experience all your fantasies with that person if they're not okay with that. So in other words, if I'm going to look for a long-term partner, that I have to be a little realistic that they won't fulfill all of my fantasies, and that's okay. Or just saying, I just want my fantasies fulfilled, so I'll go and do them with different people before I get involved with somebody.
Well, that's certainly one way to do it. I mean, but if those fantasies are that important to you, you're going to want them in more than that one time, is my experience. And so it's really important to, it's again part of your criteria for being in a relationship. You may, if this person isn't able or willing to meet those fantasies, what is your agreement going to be about that? I was having this discussion with somebody yesterday. It was like, who's around all these men in their 60s, and they're not getting any sex at home because their wife has gone through menopause and lost interest in sex. And so they're climbing the walls, and that women have this fantasy that when they lose their sex drive, their husband have lost it too. And that's simply not true. Mm-hmm. And so you have all these guys who are going absolutely crazy because they're trying to stay in the relationship, but they're not getting their needs met in any way. And again, communication never stops, because as we age, our needs, our wants change, and what's going on inside of us change, and we have to talk to our partners about that. Mm-hmm. It isn't just the same old from day one to the end. It doesn't work that way. Because we evolve, we change. We've lived out that fantasy, we're not interested in that more, but this one... Or you get into these tantric states and you get into these deep levels of vulnerability and exposure and trust, and all of a sudden it's a whole brand new world. And that, to me, is the whole point of a long-term relationship, is to be able to get into those that other world and explore something that is simply beyond words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the idea of changing needs is very important, and also the idea that you can re-spark things too through effort. Like, you don't have to just say, okay, this is how it's going to be, and say, okay, let's, again, through communication, figure out what we can do about it. If we can, we will. Because I have a client who does some kind of a work with Tantra, and she said that there are quite a few marriages that would last if people would communicate and they had the exercises and skills. She said that it's not as hard as they think, you know, and that's what she's been doing a long time. And I said, that's a really interesting point.
But it's about getting vulnerable. They have to talk about their changes and their needs, and maybe not know what they do need, but they need to figure that out. But that's something they should be figuring out together.
Right.
It's not just over here. There's another person involved in this. And so the number one thing we should teach couples getting married is that they need to talk. And they need to talk about the real stuff, mm-hmm. and not just the easy stuff or the kids or the jobs or whatever. They need to talk about what's really going on inside of them. Mm. And so if they can't do that, they're not really well matched.
Mm. That's where I have found personally keeping a journal where I air whatever is a problem first to myself, that it allows it out, and then I can breathe a little and say, okay, now I've said it to myself. I've admitted something that maybe I didn't even want to admit to myself. Putting it on paper actually is a relief, you know? So maybe if people did that initially too, it might make it easier to then say, now I can talk to someone about it because I've already put it out there. At least it's helped me. It was a recommendation I had from an astrologer that I really took seriously. I don't know why.
Well, and it spoke to you on a right level.
It's helped me a lot, you know?
Well, there's a lot of studies that show that people who keep daily journals are more organized and more focused, and that their minds are higher functioning because they're getting it out. It's just not all this stuff bouncing around in here, and you have it on paper, so I don't have to think about that anymore. If I want to revisit that, I can, or I can think about it, but it's gone. It's been purged in some way. And then I personally keep one as well. I've kept one now daily for the last 10 years or something like that, and it's really been a really profound experience for me, and it'll be the basis of my next book.
That too.
So
you get a lot
there's a lot of usefulness that I can actually go back to. Oh, I really said that. Wow.
Well, that's a good segue to talk about what you're doing right now, and what I know you're going to get the Unspoken Boundaries workshop started soon.
God willing. It's been a 2-year process. I've been doing these workshops, full day workshops called Unspoken Boundaries. Then COVID hit and I had to shorten it to a 2.5-hour online workshop. And I did those for quite a while. And it got clear that there needed to be so much more. And there was so much more information I had to share about this. So for the past 2 years, I have been developing 7 Steps to Powerful Boundaries that take people really through the whole course of their life and how they became them is the first step. The second step, I actually give them all these definitions of boundaries, is what people normally think of. But the third step, I introduce them to energetic boundaries, which I think are essential for people to know how to be functional in the world. And then fourth step is really about teaching people how to say no. I call it a guilt-free no, because we live in a society that saying no isn't very popular. And people feel bad because they have to say no, or they feel guilty or shame. And none of that's necessary or appropriate. It's called self-care. And there's times to not say no, but generally saying no is self-care. You have to take care of you and take care of things. It's the longest, most intense workshop. It's well worth it. Step five is a deeper dive into energetic boundaries, and I bring the spiritual piece into that. Step six, I actually talk about karma a lot and educate people about what karma is and isn't, how you deal with it. And I talk about this spectrum of interoception to clairvoyance, how introspection, intuition, clairvoyance is all the same thing. They just simply relate to different parts of you and you access the information differently, but it all shows up exactly the same. And so I teach people about that and then give them some exercises on deepening their intuition, because that's really the key to the whole thing. And then the last one is really taking the bigger pieces of this and really looking, putting all seven steps together for something that is about you and whatever your spirituality is, whatever that means to you, and really empowering all of it. It really is the integration of all the other pieces.
And will these be all online workshops for people?
It's all
going to
be completely online, on demand. It'll be on the Podia system, though you'll just see the website, unspokenboundaries.com. And it should be available sometime in May, as far as projections. I just literally recorded all of the workshops for the second time last week. I think it was last week. I've lost track of time. And I'm really excited to share it with the world. And it's really amazing how it's all come together. It's really the culmination of my life's work in many ways.
Well, I know we've talked about it before. I took the one workshop in person, and I found it extremely valuable. I don't do many workshops anymore. One, because I need to practice what I know, and I don't do that enough. Like many people, I love workshops. It's not like I don't love them. But it was really extremely helpful, to the point where it made a big difference with not letting certain thoughts in my mind during the day that I was really trying not to, but I just didn't know how. You know, I tried all other things, you know, so that's, it really did have an amazing effect.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, and I still do the little meditations.
Yay! They work.
They do.
They really work.
They really
do. They're simple, but they really work.
Yeah, and that's, like I said, it's all, proof is in the pudding, but that, again, you have to do the work, but,
yeah, it's, you know. There's no free lunch, as they say. You have to actually put the effort into it to get the benefit out of it. And Unspoken Boundaries is a different way of looking at the world. Mm-hmm. But it's one that works, and the people who've done it are just kind of shocked. And I've had atheists take it, and virtually every religion and spirituality you can imagine, and all of them get something out of it who want to. I mean, there are people who are just determined to not like anything I have to say, and that's okay. Because it is a very different way of looking at the world. I mean, mm-hmm. I talk about a number of the things we talked about today in terms of boundaries and sex and all these different things. And so it's very moral. It's very straightforward. I'm not terribly subtle. It's just not how I was wired. But I think that's useful when you're teaching. You want to make it clear. And so I do my best to make it all as clear as possible. The reasons why and how it works. And give you the opportunity to try out the stuff and see if it works for you.
Mm, that's the main thing. Well, I think being direct appeals to me. And also, you are very clear with the teachings. You definitely, I didn't have any confusion there. So is there any last sort of little tidbit you'd like to share about spirituality and sex before we end the show?
One, just to remember that erotic energy is the life force energy. It's tied to chi. It's tied to all these other energetic concepts in the world. And so consequently, the more that you can deepen into that, the more that you can feel safe inside of that, the more that you can get into your own vulnerability, and particularly with another person, the more that you have access to this universal consciousness, the divine, whatever word you want to use for that. And once you actually taste that and get an experience of being in that space, and the amazing, I can't come up with words to describe that kind of ecstasy, for lack of a better description, but it is timeless. And all of a sudden the world is completely different, and you actually tap into something much bigger than this domain that we live in this reality. And that's incredibly freeing. And it also gives you a glimpse of possibility. One of the things I talk about in step seven is that once you do all of these pieces, and you learn to connect to the divine in a really profound way, then you don't fear death, because you understand this isn't it. Mm. That's just a transition to the next step, whatever that is, or the next thing. And so many people are really afraid of dying, and that's probably the number one fear in the world of what's going to happen, because they have all this coding around hell and purgatory and all this other stuff. They have these angry gods that are going to punish them. And so, but once you understand that it's actually quite different, then it can do just all this relaxation. You can just enjoy life instead of being afraid of the end of it. And that changes everything.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for that. Thanks for coming back. We really appreciate it.
So happy to be back. We always have a really good time, and our connection, the conversations always go all over the place.
It does.
But we cover a lot of ground, and it's always usually interesting and fun.
So. Good. Well, thank you. And thank you all for listening in. Join us next time as we continue to explore the esoteric and the obscure together. Have a great week.